Thank you very much. As you can appreciate, I feel under the gun now after those two introductions. And indeed, what I'm going to do is talk on a topic that's a little bit narrower than this one. I don't know whether it'll come up if I... There we go. It's always a pleasure to be talking to a CEDA grouping. I think CEDA's a wonderful organisation, John. I think it complements the work of the Commission and has provided an excellent outlet for us to talk about the findings from our work with a group of people who are interested in public policy and not just from a partisan point of view. So it's always a pleasure to come here, and I've done it quite a bit over the years. So 3 years ago, I gave a talk on national competition policy and beyond, an agenda for reform, which came out of a Productivity Commission review at that time. We just produced a draft report, and I gave a talk in Sydney and Melbourne on that topic. And the context at that stage was the conclusion of the national competition policy and the challenges that were confronting the country that were still being newly debated at that time, to do with the ageing of our population, the sustainability of our approach to natural resources, and of course the ongoing challenges of international competition and globalisation. I put up there for you just to remind you of the issues that the Commission saw as being very important at that time, and they fell into two categories. One was unfinished business, I guess, from the national competition policy, and the second was a raft of new issues which we thought were very important in terms of the future challenges, and they relate to effectively social and environmental regulation and human capital, and they share in common, as the title suggests, the need for nationally coordinated reform. Well, about a year later, the national reform agenda was hatched, overlapping to a significant extent with that agenda, but also, being in Victoria, I should say, the very strong support of Victoria, including evidence-based work that it had done that effectively complemented, again, the work that the Commission had done. And the three streams of the national reform agenda are set out there. And it's, in a sense, again, old business, important business, but old business and new business, part of which is in the regulatory area, and I'll come to that, and importantly in the area of human capital. Now, I should say, in establishing the architecture of the National Reform Agenda, there were some considerable tensions that were observable to me as a, what I'd call an insider-outsider in public policy or within government. The architecture did not have the coherence, I think, of the national competition policy. In particular, the role of the National Competition Council was not evident in what was being developed through the COAG Reform Council. And competition payments were missing. And whenever I come to Victoria and I talk about competition payments, anyone from government nods and so on. And they are a feature of the new agenda, which is pretty important, and I'll come back to that. And in fact, when I did that review of NCP, I was astonished at the extent to which a little bit of money bought quite a lot of reform. And that was certainly, I thought, in the national interest, and we said so in that report. Well, the national reform agenda has been refocused and extended in the December meeting of COAG. It was a Christmas gift, I guess, for reformers, those of us who are reformers, and a short holiday for those of us who were public officials, particularly, well, generally, actually, not just within the Commonwealth domain. Those changes gave COAG a much stronger oversight role and a much stronger and I'd say more elaborate administrative support mechanisms involving seven working groups that I've set out there. And they extend beyond the national reform agenda as it was, with a couple of areas like housing and Indigenous reform. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the first five of those in particular. They involve the potential for significantly large gains, but they also are not easy areas for public policy, as you'll see from just looking at them. The national reform agenda is very much directed at two of the three P's in Ken Henry's elegant exposition that you might recall that he gave at the time of the intergenerational report. And I'm not going to conduct a lesson in basic GDP arithmetic, but it sets out there the role of those three important drivers. Now, as you know from the debate at that time and my earlier talk, I spent some time on this and I won't today, but ageing effectively cuts labour force participation in half, one of the important determinants of GDP and its growth, with now familiar impacts on per capita GDP growth. and also impacts on government budgets that got a lot of attention at that time and are still hovering there in the background, and again with the focus of my talk. Now the question arises, if ageing is the problem, why not tackle the first P and not just be confined to the second and third? In other words, why not address the question of population directly? Clearly it's an issue that is more within the Commonwealth domain than the states. But the Commission's research suggests that it's actually not a very prospective area for policy directed at offsetting the impacts of ageing. The ageing phenomenon is predominantly a consequence of increased longevity, which everybody here, I think, will agree is a good thing, not the reduction in fertility. And many of us will think the reduction in fertility has probably been a good thing too. Changes in fertility are very slow to work their way through. Anyone here with kids knows that they take a hell of a long time to grow up. And it raises dependency, which you can relate to as well, in the meantime, including fiscal dependency. So the impacts are relatively minor when you think about the changes in fertility that are feasible or imaginable. And the other point is that fertility is rather hard to influence by public policy, which again you can relate to. The Commission's analysis suggests that the recent gains in the fertility rate haven't been really a result of public policy, but rather income growth and what the technicians call the tempo effect of people delaying children more or less at about the same time and then all having them more or less at about the same time, and that's what we've been seeing. So it hasn't been a consequence of the baby bonus, in case anybody was wondering about that, and indeed you could argue that that form of intervention has possibly had some perverse impacts at the bottom of the income scale. Thinking about population, you might think about immigration. We've also done some work on that. And again, the long-run impact of changes in immigration, or feasible changes in immigration, are quite small because immigrants age too, like the rest of us. And indeed, we did some calculations in the Commission at what the rate of migration would have to be to feasibly offset the ageing of the structure of the population. And we'd have to have immigration at the rate of 3% of the population. And if we did that, that's what would happen to population. There's a much bigger impact on population than on the structure of population. So we'd become a population superstar, but I don't think we really see ourselves going there. So the NRA, after all, is well directed, I think, at those other two P's. Well, if we think about participation first, I guess the point that the Commission's tried to make in a number of things, partly to balance the debate on this, is that participation is not an end in itself. If it was, we'd all want to be in Ethiopia. Poor countries tend to have the highest participation rates for reasons that would be presumably pretty well apparent. Not necessarily great jobs, but people are out there working. So in looking at the whole question of participation and how you improve it through policy, you need to be considering the benefits and the costs and looking at situations where participation is lower than it should be given people's preferences, underlying preferences for work over leisure. That's a complicated calculation because it means looking at who you're talking about and what they're currently doing and the time frame in which in bringing them back into the workforce, some benefits may be expected to arise. For example, some calculations have suggested that those who are involved outside the economy in doing work as carers or volunteers are actually doing work that would add up to the equivalent of about 12% of GDP. So in a well-being sense, which is really what we're all thinking about in terms of economic reform, there are some significant trade-offs there. Well, participation currently is actually historically high, mainly because of women who are the emerging participators while blokes are going in the other direction. But when you look at Australia's participation rates, while historically high and pretty good overall in relation to the OECD, there's some key areas where we think compared to so-called comparable countries, we could do a lot better. And the gains from achieving those sort of comparable results are potentially quite large, and I'll come back to that. Well, the second area I wanted to talk about, and this is why it's going to take me longer than I thought, because once I get onto productivity, you can't stop me, but the second area, we've talked about participation a little bit, is productivity. And given labour utilisation rates, in the long term, it really is all about productivity. That's what drives income growth in the longer term. And it has been the target for the micro-reforms through the 80s and continuing into the 90s, which have been directed in a number of areas. One is to improve the incentives on firms and people to perform coming through the market. The other is to improve the capacity of firms to respond to the competitive incentives and disciplines that have emerged. And industrial relations has played a very important role in giving firms that flexibility to respond to the circumstances of their particular markets. And also through lowering costs for firms, and the standout example there is infrastructure, which, as you all know, was at one time the preserve of pretty fat, lazy statutory monopolies. And the interesting thing is when we lowered the barriers at the border, a lot of firms started to look at these costs, and a second wave of reform was driven by that external competitive pressure in those areas. Well, the results of that looked pretty good. When I gave talks in the early part of this new century, I'm still getting used to saying that, it was a pretty good story. I gave a couple of talks overseas, which just amazed people, at the surge in productivity growth that occurred in Australia in the 90s, outstripping the USA, which was getting a lot of the accolades at the time. So we were the quiet achievers through that period. That record has been a bit lost, I guess, in the current debate about what's happened since, and you'd have to say that our experience since then has been relatively mediocre. Now, the slump that we've observed since that 94-99 productivity cycle can be explained in part by some aberrations that have occurred within the Australian economy. One of them is the drought, or I should say multiple droughts, which have pulled back agricultural production, obviously, and with predictable effects on productivity. But the second one, on which the Commission's doing a paper which should come out shortly, is on the mining boom, which has had two sorts of effects. One is there's a transitional effect as production technology is gearing up to accommodate the increased demand, and we've seen a greater use of workers in that early phase, but then investment that's being outlaid but not actually productive yet. So that's one effect. And the second is that with prices being as high as they are, there's obviously profit to be made in going for lower-grade ore, extracting lower-grade ore, and that again flows through into what would look like lower productivity. So hence, MFP in particular has dropped off. I should say that that last bar isn't a full cycle. That's just the years that we've experienced so far. But if you do a calculation and take mining and agriculture out of the MFP calculation, you can see that it's actually done reasonably well. More broadly than that, what we've observed in our research is that we've seen the surge in demand that's been occurring through a more prosperous economy as well as internationally being reflected in more investment and more hiring to expand output relative to productivity gains per se. So output growth actually has been pretty strong if you look after the 93-94 to 99 period. But when you factor in terms of trade, income growth has been even stronger. So the fixation of public debate on productivity alone is clearly misplaced from that, because what it's really all about is income growth. And it's not that our current productivity performance is an indicator of our potential or our total performance, but in some respects is the mirror image of what's been happening with the terms of trade and commodity prices and booming conditions, which, after all, are flowing through to higher incomes, which is what it's all about. So, having said that, we should see a recovery in productivity as presumably the droughts come to an end and as mining productivity improves. And that's very important, because we can't necessarily expect that terms of trade increases will continue, even if the terms of trade hold up reasonably well. And we should be able to expect the legacy of past reforms, which have created ongoing incentives for a more competitive economy, to have some durable impact. But on the other hand, we can't rely on those things, and we need to do what we can do to influence both productivity and participation, and that is the focus of the National Reform Agenda. Now, some of you will have seen the modelling work that the Commission did to basically help COAG get over the line on this in demonstrating the gains that were there to be had. I don't have time to go through all that. Two quick points I'll make. One, if you look at the above-the-line stuff, which is probably more traditional economic reform, red tape stands out, and I'll come back to that. Below the line, Clearly, there's a lot of potential action in getting human capital right, flowing through to participation and productivity. While we had lots of caveats in the report about not adding up the numbers, if you did want to add them up, you get to about $100 billion, which is what David Uren did in The Australian. But in fact, the numbers below the nine are not comparable because they're gross numbers. They don't have in them the costs of the programs that are needed to bring about the improvements in education, health, etc., that lie behind those participation and productivity numbers. So I'd now like to make some comments on the areas that have been identified in the COAG working groups. As I said, the top five, and they're very selective comments. I'm giving another speech at the end of the month to, I don't know whether I'm allowed to advertise it or not, John, but the Australian and the Melbourne Institute are having their Economic and Social Outlook conference, and I'll be giving a talk then. So you're getting an early instalment of this. But as a result, I'm sort of cutting corners. There will be a paper available at the end of the month as well that obviously will encompass what I'm going to say today. I guess the points that I'll be trying to make and emphasise the themes in what I'm saying is that there's incredible potential in each of these areas, but realising that potential raises a number of policy issues and complexities that aren't always being debated and I think need to be. And there's going to need to be a lot more what I'd call front-end work in terms of policy development if we're to realise through this more promising COAG process the gains that are potentially on offer in each of these areas. Well, the first one, health and ageing, some of you who might remember that early chart will have seen that the bar to do with health, healthcare costs in an ageing society is a very interesting one. Essentially, we're going to see a very substantial increase. I don't know whether many of you saw that movie Sicko that, what's his name? Michael Moore did, but I did notice a discernible feeling in the theatre when I watched it that things weren't so bad in Australia after all. And when you knew a bit about the countries that he was comparing favourably, actually like Canada and the UK, I felt even better. We do stack up pretty well in OECD comparisons in terms of health outcomes and indeed the system effectiveness, the effectiveness overall of our health system, and indeed even the cost effectiveness traditionally. But the cost side of things is starting to increase. We're now spending something like 10% of GDP, and it has been rising. And the nature of our health system gives rise to problems of cost containment, questions of targeting, and also the need to maintain quality. So we've got lots of issues there. But the cost blowout that's already occurring is anticipating what is going to be a demographically driven increase in health spending that's set out on that chart. So sensibly enough, a key focus of this health and ageing working group is prevention, on the presumption that prevention is better than cure. The point that I'd like to pre-announce is generally that's right, that's a good saying, but not always, and it depends on the cost of prevention relative to the costs of cure, and it's quite a complex area. Chronic disease accounts for about 80% of the disease expenditure burden and has quite significant effects on both participation and productivity. But when we struggled with this in our report on the National Reform Agenda, it wasn't clear to us what proportion of that was amenable to policy. The causes are quite complex, and the risk factors in chronic disease also are quite complex and quite variable. And if you take one that at face value is a very sensible area for targeting, and that is obesity, which is a factor in diabetes and cardiovascular and other diseases, and you look at it about how easy it is to deal with that, and I have my own personal challenge in that area. It's a reflection of, I think, modern lifestyles and what one doctor described as the most powerful urge on earth. Dealing with that is not easy. I mean, advertising, information, even people who go on diets highly motivated by the need to find another partner or something like that, find that they cannot sustain that weight loss. And the programs that are directed at lifestyle, etc., can be quite expensive. Some examples that I'll give in the paper amounting to billions of dollars. So I guess what that calls for there, and that's just an example, but in the area of preventative healthcare and what we can do about that, very promising, but it's going to need a rigorous program of research, of piloting, and in particular program evaluation, something that we're not very good at in this country, and I'll come back to that. So they're areas where we don't know enough, and I'd contrast the two, and I won't have time to go through these in any detail, where we know quite a lot, but politics is getting in the way of progress. One is the health workforce, which has a silo mentality about it that's getting in the way, I think, of the sort of innovation and reform that we need. The second is aged care, where I think we have a system that's not really equipped to handle the increased demands that will come about from, in particular, the increase, the tripling of the proportion of the population aged above 85. I mean, we think about what's happening with the doubling of over 65, but when you're talking about aged care, it's the oldest old that we're talking about, and that's the area that's going to grow very fast. Well, the second area, the second working group is devoted to education and training. I think the headline is productivity agenda, but it's really about human capital development that these people are focusing on. And that is obviously very important, and everybody in this room will understand that. And it's particularly important, I think, going forward, where presumably we've stopped doing a lot of the really silly things that were holding back our productivity. And going forward, it's really going to be innovation, service quality, things that have to do with the quality of people that I think are going to make a big difference to our performance. Well, we know that education is obviously fundamental to all this, and the statistics tell us that the more education you have, the more likely you are to participate. There's some complexities in that again, but that's broadly the story. And there clearly, when you look at Australia compared to other comparable countries, there's scope to do a lot better, particularly in relation to retention at school in the higher level years, but also the long tail of relatively poor performance that many of you will have heard about in Australia. Now, reforms have been undertaken in various ways, and they are having an effect. But the point I just wanted to make today briefly, if I can, is that the key to educational performance, I think everybody in this room would agree, is quality teaching. Now, the interesting thing is when I looked in the December communique, there was no mention of teachers in that communique, or indeed quality teaching. Teachers weren't even mentioned as a stakeholder in the system in a long list of other stakeholders that were mentioned. Now, I understand that was an oversight, and clearly a focus is going on teaching in that working group. But you could say that underside is a reflection of the undervaluation of teachers in contemporary society. That tells part of the story. The other one, when you think about it, the top salary for a classroom teacher in Australia is about $70,000. Now, that's what the average, well, I could even say a mediocre public servant in Canberra would expect to be earning after 2 years. It's probably not much more than a bus driver would be getting. So there are questions, I think, there about remuneration. And that's not to say that teachers are primarily motivated by remuneration. I don't think they are. Many of them see it as a vocation. But those kinds of disparities are likely to have an impact over time, and we've already seen what that impact is in terms of the flight of males from the profession and the shortages that we're observing in what I'd call the harder disciplines, where we're seeing teachers who are not qualified. We're also seeing the academic aptitude of entrance to the teaching profession dropping very significantly over time. Now, there's a range of other issues to do with what I'd call the education workforce that I think need to be looked at. The focus on reducing class sizes has failed. I think, despite the evidence, a lot of focus has gone on reducing class sizes. The evidence tells us that doesn't make a lot of difference unless you're getting down to class sizes of, you know, half a dozen people or something like that. The focus needs to go back onto our teachers, our educators, and what it takes to bring the best out of them and to get the best people. Well, you can see the challenges I had to get through this quickly, because I'm now onto climate change and water. I've got Geoff Love in the room, so I'll have to be very quick on the climate change side of things. They're both in the same working group. They are related, but they're kind of different in a sense. Greenhouse, I guess it's been a long time for us as a country to decide what national approach we'll take. Water, we decided a long time ago, but it's taken a hell of a long time to actually do it. On climate change, it's almost not worth starting unless I spent a lot of time on it. There's so much that's being said about this, but I just wanted to reinforce a few things that the Commission has tried to highlight in some of the reports that it's done. And we did do one back in 91 that I headed, actually, which was the first modelling exercise of its kind. What came through then and is still true now is we are a highly carbon-intensive economy with our fossil fuel, low-cost fossil fuel resources, but we are a very low aggregate contributor to a global problem. That means the cost benefit of anything we do is inevitably going to be negative. It will be negative, at least pending global action. So the transition is extremely important. What we do between now and when we get global action for Australia is particularly important. And indeed, the objective of this working group has talked about in terms of effectiveness and effective policy, but cost-effective, I think, is a better term to describe the challenge that we face in this interim period. I don't think there's been enough talk about the costs of action. I think there's been a concern to actually do something, but I think now we have to really focus on the costs and how we can minimise those. And there are two areas in particular that aren't talked a lot about, and I'm not going to talk a lot about them. One is adjustment costs, and we know they can be quite high. And the second is regulatory costs themselves, particularly compliance costs, which I've just spent a bit of time a year or so ago discovering are very high as well, and the Commission's modelling confirms that. This is going to be the biggest regulatory challenge that this country has ever faced. We haven't even faced small regulatory challenges all that well in the past, in terms of, in particular, the compliance costs that are involved, even if we get the broad directions right. Attention to the detail, attention to the compliance costs of action is extremely important, I think. The only other point I'd make is we've got a system with multiple belts and braces at the moment, and that's going to need to be sorted out now that we've got as we're moving towards having a carbon price signal. And what we do with the MREET at the top of the list there, I think, is included in that, yet it's being treated somewhat differently at the moment in the way policy is being developed. Well, the second area is water. That this working group is dealing with. So it's got two very important issues for Australia, probably two of the most important, I think. And there's two elements to the water policy challenge facing Australia. One is the unfinished business in rural markets, and you read a lot about that, the limits and constraints on the way the market is operating, both regionally in terms of and the players in the trades, etc., the high transaction costs, all of that. Governance arrangements are pretty important. The notion of moving to national governance for water that transcends individual jurisdictions, I think, is impeccable logic. But how we do that, obviously, is very important. And you could characterise aspects of the $10 billion plan as a costly way of buying national control, particularly given some of the infrastructure subsidies that were embedded in that. But the second point, and the one that I wanted to emphasise, and we've got some work coming out shortly that you'll be able to read, is that we don't have any market at all in relation to urban water. That's a slight exaggeration, which I'll be taking to task for back at the Commission, but I think it's by and large correct. We don't see prices doing the job in particular at the current time of dealing with scarcity, which is something we all know markets are pretty good at dealing with, right? Instead, we've had a focus predominantly on the demand side, on restricting the demand, and there's a lot of work that tells us, apart from our intuition, that that's a very costly and expensive way to go. So we need to rethink our whole approach to urban water. We need to think about generating prices that provide signals that tell people what the real value of water is, not just the pipes and stuff that deliver it, but the scarcity value at various times. And I believe, and our report tries to show, that would be both more efficient but also more equitable. There's nothing all that equitable about little old ladies carrying buckets to try to keep their roses alive, while people who've got a lot more money, their gardeners are using bore water or they're bringing it in, trucking it in commercial quantities. So I think there's a lot of public debate that has to be had. The issues are complex. There's something sacred about every drop of water, et cetera. But I think it's a debate that we really have to have moving forward, and hopefully we can make a contribution to that. Well, I'm not even meeting my extended time frame, but I have to spend some time on infrastructure, or John will never forgive me. Obviously, infrastructure is fundamental. CEDA's done some excellent work in drawing that to public attention. The reforms in the infrastructure space, I think, were important drivers of the overall gains that we got from the national competition policy, and there's unfinished business to be had. I think the gains that I see in the future come from finally getting national markets operating properly, but also from better investment, most importantly, from better investment. And that doesn't necessarily mean more government spending, by the way. The working group in this area is focused in particular on the adequacy issues in the light of the blockages, export infrastructure blockages debate, and also the questions of planning and coordination. So it has a strong public sector focus to it. There's been a call for a national audit of adequacy, which in the time, all I'll say is very complex. At the end of the day, it comes down to understanding the costs and benefits of individual investments relative to others, and in particular those costs and benefit analysis has to be done in a forward-looking context. It's about what the future requirements are, and again governments haven't typically been all that good at that, and in their own investment behaviour they've gone from one extreme to the other. Think of the rash of dams etc. that were being built at one stage and then going completely in the opposite direction. Roads have been a political plaything I think for forever. And railways, similarly, despite the cost-benefit analysis that were repeatedly done, for example, on the two icon projects, the Alice Springs to Darwin Railway and the Melbourne to Brisbane Inland Rail, they got political favour, whereas you had to build a lot of blue sky into those cost-benefit analysis to get them over the line. So government is still a dominant infrastructure provider. Performance of government enterprises have improved, but not really enough, and more than half are still not making a commercial return on their assets. There's some major governance issues, I think, still in the way we operate our GTEs, and in particular the way that flows through into investment decisions. Well, my paper will talk more fully about the role of private ownership, which on the one hand has fantastic incentives for reducing costs, but also fantastic incentives for maximising profits. And in areas where natural monopoly pervade or there's very strong distributional or equity issues, that's led to regulation. The idea Hilmer had was that it would be very light-handed. I think in the natural course of things with regulations and regulators is that it becomes more heavy-handed over time. And I think there has been a worry that that's been impacting on investment. So the very thing that we're worried about, scarcity, shortages, I think can be linked much more directly than is often done to the regulatory framework rather than the budgets of government, to the extent that you've got private capital willing and able to come into this space. So I've saved myself a couple of minutes there. And I'll just get on to business regulation and competition, which is the last of the working groups that I wanted to talk about. The past reforms that I talked about earlier really were focused on reducing or removing anti-competitive regulation, regulation that benefited some at the costs of others. The new wave or the new priorities that are emerging are really about reforming regulation that's pretty much costly to the generality of business, and it comes under the rubric of red tape. And you would have seen on the earlier chart what the potential payoff from that could be if 25% of estimates of total compliance burden were able to be stripped out, and there's quite a bit of evidence that that could be done. Well, the work that I did and others have done came up with a whole bunch of common regulatory problems where we observe costs being higher than they are. The two that I'd mention in the context of the NRA are the last two, where we've got complexity compounded by national fragmentation. Federations in principle are great things for policy experimentation. Our own federation has had lots of experiments but very little convergence. We haven't been good at learning from the policy experiments of individual jurisdictions. And I think the case is therefore quite strong that we need to accelerate the move to harmonisation in areas where those experiments are telling us that there's a way forward. Now, not all of those areas there are so clearly delineated as that, but I think COAG has identified a number that are pretty important nationally. Progress has been pretty slow. We'll see what happens now. I think occupational health and safety is going to be a litmus test to that. Okay, again, you'll have to wait for my speech to see what I have to say about that. But again, we haven't traditionally learned too much about other jurisdictions. The debate has been affected by that, and this is an exercise that the Commission's undertaking for COAG, which will be benchmarking business regulation around the country to see who does it best, even though the indicators will be pretty rough. So watch that space. We've got a draft report coming out in June and a final, I think, in August. But look, in the long term, I guess the most important issue in this space really is to improve the processes and institutions responsible for regulation and for administering regulation. None of that occurs in a vacuum. It occurs in a political environment, and that political environment generates, by and large, knee-jerk political reactions to society's problems for reasons that I've gone through in great detail in other papers, etc. Now, COAG has focused on this area, which I think is a step forward. I don't believe it's a big enough step. I think a lot of the action is still at the surface. And I think some of the actions that the Commonwealth undertook in response to the review I headed up provide a cause for some optimism that we'll be able to entrench good process more successfully than we have in the past. But again, we'll have to watch that space. In particular, there's now a provision at the Commonwealth level that regulation that does not follow best practice, as defined in terms of assessing the cost of benefits, etc., cannot proceed to a decision, whether in Cabinet or elsewhere, unless the Prime Minister gives it a leave pass. I think that's a very important provision. It also brings political leadership into the equation, which is going to be absolutely fundamental if we're going to make progress. All right, I think I've got 2 minutes out of my extended time frame, and I'll just make a couple of comments in conclusion. Well, I have confined myself to the NRA, and there'll be people around here who are thinking I haven't covered their pet topic, but I did want to focus on that because that's something that's happening right now. There's a meeting of COAG later this month, and you'll all be wanting to look under all of those areas to see what is actually happening. There are a bunch of other areas that are also very important that are either more jurisdictionally based or are not being covered by COAG. I won't go through all of those, but they have, a lot of those within jurisdictional ones have their own dynamic about them. The important thing about these ones is we're not going to get progress as a country unless we get coordinated reform, unless we get agreement among those who've got divided roles and responsibilities in that area, and that is the great strength of the national reform agenda. Well, why should we have hope in COAG? I think things have improved. Reform payments, which are an important feature of the national competition policy, are back on the table. My judgment is that they're necessary and they will drive reform in areas that are quite tricky or where individual states sort of feel that on balance it's not worth it. The COAG oversight arrangements are much stronger. They're somewhat elaborated and we're going to have to watch how that plays out. There are a lot of people running around in circles at the moment and they've got 3-month timeframes. How all that plays out is going to be very interesting, I think, particularly given, as I said, a lot of the issues here are not straightforward. They're going to require good front-end policy development. Now, how does that fit in with a 3-month timeframe mentality? That's going to be a challenge, I think, all round to achieve that. Because even where we know the answer, in some areas like occupational health and safety, we might feel we know the answer, but the political disagreement is still quite strong, and I think there's still a case for working that through and getting a basis for broader political agreement. And the last point that I'll end on, I think if we're going to have a new federation, and there's lots of evidence that we may be able to do much better things in the federal space than previously, we need much better mechanisms for learning about what works best across our federation. We haven't been good at that. In a whole range of areas, we've had many promising policy experiments that have just withered on the vine, and we haven't learned from them. Indigenous policy is perhaps the most important one, where it was absolutely vital that we learn about what worked in terms of all those myriads of things that have been done for the last 3 decades, and we haven't learned much at all. Now, hopefully, even there, that's changing with the COAG process that's generating information of that kind. But that's the strength of the Federation. Let's use it, and I'll end on that note. Thank you.